lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Jennifer S. Eccles with us. She's the author of Simply Salsa Dancing Without Fear at God's Fiesta. She's a sought-after teacher, a speaker, a ministry leader, and an author who tells her brave story and inspires others in her Amazon's number one best-selling, again, Simply Salsa, Dancing Without Fear at God's Fiesta. And let us say, Janet, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Oh, by the way, I can hear the energy in your voice. Let's go all the way back to a part of your life where you actually lost your eyesight. What was life like at that moment? Was it all encompassing, it's over with and I'm done, or was there that point where you felt inside that this could even be better for you?
You know, all of the above. There was a time, of course, I was only 31, it was unexpected, and I decided that, you know, I was being punished. So I was filled with self-pity, with anger and bitterness, all those things that one goes through with tragedy that's unexpected. And I had three little boys at the time. But then eventually, what I did is basically fought giving up, because truthfully, that might have been an option had I not just looked up and just through prayer and God's intervention turned everything around. Of course, it didn't happen overnight.
No. But let me ask you this. When blindness, there are people who have eyesight that are absolutely blind. Have you redefined your definition of that word?
You know, I tell you what, this is how my life was. When I could see physically, I was blind to the meaning of life. I was blind to the purpose of what brings joy and happiness and peace. And so when I did lose my sight eventually, and I started my new chapter, life to me looked different. In every sense, it looked better because my focus changed, my attitude changed. And right now, and I've said this before, and people probably roll their eyes when they hear this, in so many ways, being blind is a blessing because
sure.
I learned to live in a different way, more meaningful.
No, there is no question about it whatsoever. And you go through these challenges in your life, and my goodness, there's nothing going to replace your 19-year-old son. But at the same time, there's a legacy that you'll leave him, and you'll be able to touch others in a way that you could have never done so before. There are things that can't come back to you, but in their own way, they manifest in such different ways of being.
That's true. The mom who shares with me, you know, I lost my child too, and I don't think I can go on. I don't think I'll ever overcome this anguish and this agonizing pain. But because I've gone through it, I can say, yes, you can. Let me show you. Let me prove to you that, yes, life will come back. It will never be the same, but you'll still be able to laugh, to have joy, and enjoy life. Now, that is a privilege for me now. I would have never been able to do that if I had not walked in that path myself. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right. It did give me that the privilege and that platform to do that. So, thus, you know, my writing and speaking. So,
well, sure. And by the way, the husband that betrayed you, he was unfaithful to you. You should send him flowers because you'd have never met your present husband if he hadn't have done it.
Oh, you got it. Are you ready for this? Oh, this is a beautiful story. The same husband who decided he was going to leave me right after I lost my sight, of course, that rejection plus my blindness almost just devastated me.
Sure.
But what happened is that I grew a different sense of confidence, security, poise, and grace, and dignity to face him and say, you know what, if you want to walk away, you go right ahead, because I know where my confidence comes from, not from a husband, not from someone else, but from God. And do you know, Mike, that he turned around and he decided to be committed to our boys, committed and devoted to me. We healed our marriage, fell in love all over again.
Oh, so
and
it's him.
Celebrating. Yes. So
say, thank you for leaving me, you brand new I love you person. Yes.
There you go. Yes. I love you again. Do you love me?
but very interesting. We hide inside of ourselves. And sometimes it takes those things to bring us out into the open, because we're so frightened of coming out and letting somebody see who we are. And it's about time that most people just stopped it and allowed people to see who they are. And a lot of the problems that we have on this planet would stop. Now, women today, they imprison themselves. I'm not talking about those that get caught in, the human trafficking and so on and so forth. That's a horrible thing. But there are so many people that create their own prisons because, again, they're frightened to step out and be who they are.
That is so true. Yeah, that's such an important insight, because that's where lies all the depression, the self-pity, the gloom, because you're not saying, you know what, I'm hurting and I'm going to do something about it. Yes, life has been unfair, but there's got to be something else. They're just choosing to dwell on that. And when you decide to say, I'm going to face my pain, my situation, and I know that I'm going to conquer it, there's such freedom in that. And I have been, I guess, just so honored and so blessed and privileged to be able to see the good choices that I have made and the places that choice has taken me. And it's one of freedom, like you said. So.
Now, by the way, one of the other things that I know you discuss, and it's very true, discovering the hidden skills. There are so many things that we have the ability to do, and sometimes it takes getting knocked down to be able to see those things.
Well, you know what I tell people? I say, when I lost my sight, my brain kicked in. Because after I lost my sight, I developed a skill to be an interpreter. I learned to use a computer. I began my speaking ministry. I began to write. And who would have thought? All those things never crossed my mind when I could see. I would have never dreamed I could do all those things. But it's amazing how us humans have the potential to overcome, to be productive, and to really do things that we never dreamed of when we make the decision to persevere and to at least try. So, yes, it's been an interesting journey for me.
Now, by the way, there is no question about it, and especially I think today, in today's world, with the economy the way it is, with the news media doing what the news media does, with politics the way they are, this one's no good and that one's no good. It's not about the population in and of itself. There are a tremendous amount of people who are frightened today. They don't know what's the uncertainty. They don't know what's going to go on tomorrow, and they get into this fear syndrome, and they get into this despair. And they don't know what to do about it because they don't think they're in control of it. And my feeling, Janet, is when you really come down to it, I don't care what goes on around you. You have the control if you stop and look within yourself to find it.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, as you said, the economy, the situation around us, all the bad news. Fear has to be it is a big part of what's really bringing people down right now. The fear of tomorrow, fear, the uncertainty. But what I found is that when you succeed in finding ways to conquer fear, success will find you. The success to overcome, to live a life that's, with joy instead of fear, with confidence instead of insecurities. And in my years of trying to overcome the fear of living the rest of my life blind, I just learned a really simple exercise that I think anybody could do. And it just takes three very simple steps. Number one, if you take a few moments to think about what you fear the most right now, think about that. And instead of dwelling on what you are afraid will happen, instead think of the contrary. Think of the opposite. What if, instead of what I'm dreading, things would turn out that way? And ponder on that. Second, you have to have the discipline to control your thinking. Imagine if every morning I woke up and thought, oh, poor me, I can't see how I'm going to make myself go to the bathroom. Instead, I control the thing and say, another day that I can inspire someone. Another day that I'll be able to be productive. Number three is to be able to control. You never, ever want to say the words, I am so afraid, or I fear this or that, because it's such a powerful thing. The thoughts that you have, the words that you say, will manifest themselves in your life. And for me, that has been such a powerful, powerful exercise. And that's why I think I've been able to succeed in the career that I've been at 20 years. I've been able to have my book reach number one, is because I wasn't really dwelling on what if. What if this blind woman, you know, can't ever make it? What if I can't write? What if? Instead, I thought, wow, you know what? I think I'm going to ponder on the way that things might turn out, and I'm going to dwell on that. So it's something, you know, it's simpler than people think.
No, we got a couple of minutes to go. And people, there are so many people today that are in marriages that just aren't working. There's so many outside external influences. The tips, the things that you can talk about to make a marriage right.
Yes. Well, for me, I learned the hard way. What I did that was wrong was react to situations with my emotions. You know, me being Latina, you know, I'm all over the place. How dare you? How could you? And then I learned, you know, I have to remember that the situations don't have to control me. My emotions don't have to control me. I have a way to resolve things in a better way, maybe with poise, with dignity, and think that I have what it takes. I am worthy, and I do have the ability to resolve things in a way that doesn't have to be emotional. And I think that has helped my marriage, given me a different perspective. And I think in doing that, I gained my husband's respect. And that's so important in a marriage.
Different woman, different man, and a completely different love affair.
Yes, a better one.
Yeah. Janet, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and the book?
I do, since I inspired so many people. The website is www.inspirationforyou.com. All words spelled out, inspirationforyou.com. And that's where you'll find Simply Salsa. And, of course, where all Christian books are sold, and on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble and such.
Mm-hmm. Dynamite. Hey, Janet, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mike Schottsky with us. He is the author of The Great Fat Fraud, Why the Obesity Epidemic Isn't, How to Be Totally Healthy Without Losing Weight, and if you should lose a couple of pounds, how to keep them from coming back again. He's been a professional speaker for more than 30 years now, and again, is the author of The Great Fat Fraud. And let us say, Mike, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, everybody's frightened to death of gaining all this weight, and, you know, knock on wood, I don't have that. But what is it about the fraud? What is it that we hear that we shouldn't really listen?
Well, what we're told is that if we're heavy, we're in deep, deep trouble, that we're going to get sick, we're going to die more frequently, and that that's a disaster, and we all have to lose weight. And in fact, that's not the case.
Now, Mike, do people mistake diet for diet for nutrition? Because most people are on a diet, they have no idea what they're doing, and they're not getting healthy with what they're eating, and they're losing some of those nutrients that cause the body to work at optimal effect.
Yeah, I think a lot of us don't eat balanced meals, and we should, but the human body's pretty adaptable. I mean, there are societies out there that only eat meat and drink blood, you know, the Maasai. There are other primitive societies that have very limited diets, and they've managed to survive. And so the human body can get along on a lot of foods, provided it's not something we've invented, like trans fat.
Sure.
And so, yes, we really should eat a balanced meal. No, we shouldn't eat everyday fast food. But I don't think that's the main problem that we're facing, is not eating the right food. I think the problem that we're facing is that we're not fit enough.
Oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense, because when you really come down to it, when you're dealing with obesity, you're also dealing with, there's so many cases of heart problems and diabetes, and the list goes on and on and on. But if you stay fit, that in and of itself fights these things, and the onset of the diabetes and the whatever else is involved in it usually will take its own course, and there's health matters. So I think staying fit really is the key here.
Absolutely. And, the research is pretty conclusive. When you divide the population between those who are fit, see, most of the studies, what they do is they take the whole population. And as a result, as weight goes up, health problems go up, and death rates go up for the whole population. But that really doesn't work very well. It's sort of like as if you had done a study that only looked at lung cancer rates and income levels. And if you do that, what you'll find is that lung cancer rates go up as income levels go down. So, eureka, poverty causes lung cancer. Well, no, it doesn't. The reason you get that result is because, unfortunately, at the current time, as income rates go down, smoking rates go up. And so if you take that total population that you just studied and split them between smokers and non-smokers, what you find is that non-smokers don't get lung cancer regardless of their income, and the smokers all get lung cancer at the same rate regardless of their income. So when you take a population and split them between the fit folks and those who are not fit, what you find is those folks who are fit, regardless of their weight, have the same death rates and the same level of health problems, and all of the folks who are fit, including those who are heavy, have half the death rate of people who are thin and sedentary.
Okay, so we are dealing with I'm going to call it an anomaly. I'm going to call it something that we're trained to know, quote unquote, that if somebody's overweight, they're going to probably die, and they're not going to be healthy, and they're not going to have the decent life that somebody that is a normal weight would be. So what you're saying is that's not so.
That's right, and the research is pretty clear that it's not so.
Okay, but then what is it? Is it an income? Is it somebody making money? What is it that's causing us to believe the way we've learned to believe?
Well, the weight loss industry is a mammoth industry. I mean, it has revenues in the neighborhood of $60 billion a year. And they fund a lot of studies. There are a lot of people who work in academia who consult for them and so on and so forth. And the whole world has kind of grown into this belief, because it's repeated again and again and again, you have to lose weight. And, what other thing have we really worried about for years and years and years and talked about for years and years and years, and nothing's happened? I mean, there's been very little change in the level of weight that our country has, or even around the world. And so, A, it's not working, and B, it's not necessary, because even if you're heavy, if you get fit, and by the way, you don't have to exercise to get fit, because most people don't like exercise, but if you're heavy and you get fit, then those problems literally go away. The other thing is, a lot of people don't really care. I mean, they care about being healthy, they care about not dying, but that's later. And right now, they're saying, I don't like the way I look, and they're saying I face discrimination at work and elsewhere, and they say, I don't want to lose weight. And then what happens? They lose weight, and then what happens? They gain it back, right?
Sure.
Yeah, everybody gains it back, and you look at the studies. It's like what 80, 85, 90% of the people who lose the weight after 2 or 3 years, they've gained it back. Why? Because the body thinks that when you go on a diet, you're experiencing a famine, and so it wants to restore your fat stores, which are you know, stored energy, in case there might be another famine. Because, you know, primitive man, feast and famine was the way the world worked. And it doesn't know that we have all the food we want all the time and too much. But if we're fit, and that's the key, if they're fit, another mechanism takes hold. We get a different set point, and that's what allows us to maintain our weight, even if we've lost some.
Now, by the way, let me interrupt just for a second. Mike, define fit. What does fit actually mean? Fit to someone may mean fit to somebody else in a completely different form. What does fit mean?
The way the scientific literature comes up with fit enough is that you need to burn about 500 calories a day over what you burn if you were just sitting in front of a TV.
Okay.
And most people burn about 150 to 200 calories a day. So we have that deficit of about, you know, roughly 300 calories a day for most people.
Okay, which basically for them puts the additional weight on. All right, now, without exercising, quote-unquote, how do you get rid of it?
Well, the way you burn that extra calories is by walking. Because if you think about it, even most exercise involves moving your body from here to there, but it involves moving your body fast. If you walk, you're going to burn the same level of calories for the same distance covered, roughly, but you burn it more slowly. Most people don't like exercise. I do a program called the No Sweat Couch Potato Recovery Program, and it's a speech I give.
Yeah.
And the first thing I ask, because the big elephant in the middle of the room is exercise, right? So the first question,
sure,
I ask people is, how many of you exercise regularly? And maybe 10, 15% max of the room, I ask them to stand up, so they stand up. And the rest of the 85% don't. And then I ask them, okay, while you're standing, how many of you enjoy exercise or find it satisfying or fulfilling? Well, the people who are standing raise their hand and nobody else does. Bottom line, most of the population, 80, 85, 90%, doesn't like exercise. And no matter how much we nag them, they're not going to do it. But what they've been told is that's the only way to get fit, so they do nothing. But everybody can walk. And so if you don't like exercise, what you need to do is slowly but surely build yourself up, add 500 steps a day until that's comfortable, then add 500 steps more, get yourself a pedometer so you can measure it. And it doesn't matter how long you take. I mean, I know a woman who was 68, took her 2 years to get up to 10,000 steps from where she was about 4,000. Doesn't matter. It's a lifelong project. And now she's fit as a fiddle. So anybody who can walk can do it.
Okay, so what we're talking about is not necessarily losing a ton of weight. If somebody's 280, 290 pounds and they're 5'3", obviously it's a lot of weight. But at the same time, am I hearing you right? And or maybe I'm exaggerating it. Mike, are you saying that somebody that heavy can be healthy?
Yep.
Okay, it's fair.
Now, the only problem that they face long term is that amount of weight is going to have some impact on their joints. And that for someone who is that heavy, you know, the key to fitness is walking, unless you like swimming. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure on your joints. So someone at that level might say to themselves, you know, I probably want to lose weight. But the key is, see, almost everybody who's heavy, particularly people who are very heavy, have tried to lose weight. In fact, some of them have lost weight and gained it back. And I have a little, in the Great Fat Fraught book, we have a little quiz. And we ask people, all right, how old were you when you started dieting? What did you weigh? How many diets have you been on since you started dieting? And how much have you lost on average? And most people find that they've lost a huge amount of weight. They may be 100, some people 200, even 300 pounds. And then the last question is, what do you weigh now? And most people discover they weigh now more than when they started doing all those diets. And so the key is, if you get fit, and then you say to yourself, okay, I want a diet, You still have to diet. You know, fitness itself is not going to make you lose weight, despite all the advertisements to the contrary, because most people compensate and eat more because they're burning more calories by being fit. But if you then go on a diet and make yourself eat less and sort of suffer the tortures of a diet, then when you stop, either because you can't stand it anymore or because you've plateaued, that fitness activity, as long as you pay attention and try to keep it off, will allow you to keep it off because you're not fighting your body anymore.
Okay, so in essence, it's get in sync with your body, get in harmony, quote-unquote, balance is a better word. And if you begin to understand the dynamic of your body, what makes it work, why it will or won't work at whatever time, then it gives you a little better handle on it. And the exercise in and of itself, I can see that it does a couple of things. One, it pumps up the circulation. You get enough blood flow, you get enough oxygen. You get enough oxygen, it moves right to that immune system, and it's the immune system that's the be-all, end-all for getting yourself fixed one way or the other. And in the being fit is that bridge. It's that step to take, that extra step to take to make sure that you do stay healthy, make sure everything is working.
Absolutely. And for just a personal example, I call myself the recovering couch potato because 15 years ago, I was a couch potato. And my HDL, that's the high-density lipoproteins, which are the protective ones, were 39. 45 is considered protective. They're now up to 55 after 15 years of being fit. It comes slowly, but there are real serious physiological changes that are measurable in blood tests that can show the benefits of being fit.
Okay, now let me take you all the way back to when you started with this. What was the trigger that caused you to look into the subject in the first place?
Well, I was actually, first of all, you know, I had been a couch potato, then I got fit, made me feel great, and you know how insufferable the newly converted can be. I wanted to convert everybody. I wanted everybody to exercise. I wanted them to be fit. I quickly learned that, you know, people didn't like that. So I thought, all right, I wonder if there's anything else out there. So I started doing some research. And started reading some scientific papers. And when you do that, you kind of read more. And I developed this program called the No Sweat Couch Potato Recovery Program because I discovered that in the literature it was pretty clear that it didn't matter whether you burned the calories with exercise or with walking. It just didn't matter. But the trouble is you kept on running into articles on obesity. So, you know, I'm curious. I would follow the footnote trail. One article would lead me to another. And at the beginning, I would think I was just like everybody else. You know, being heavy is dangerous and blah, blah, blah. And I start to read some of these articles that contradict that. And I'm saying, nah, that can't be right. But the more you read, after a while, you know, you become convinced. Oh, my gosh, there really is, when you look at it, a clear consensus. And that's how I got there.
Okay, so realistically, you found out, you started spreading the word, quote, unquote, are people easy to, when I say convert, to move into this line of thinking, and it is a completely different mindset. It's a shift the way people think about their lives. And if you can shift that and step outside the way you normally think, all of a sudden things can change. But you got to be able to take that first step.
Right, and that's why I wrote the book, because it's not enough for me to just tell you this. You're going to say, well, you know, prove it to me. You know, who are the experts? Who's the expert here? And so the book, in a sense, is a convening of the experts. In fact, one reviewer on Amazon called the book The Cliff Notes for the New England Journal of Medicine, and I thought that was really cool because I hadn't thought of it that way. But what we're trying to do here is essentially convene in one spot all the knowledge of the experts in a really easy way to read and digest, so that when you look at it, you say, wait a minute, you know, everybody starts out being so skeptical because we've been told so much the opposite. And it's not enough for me to just say, okay, go out and walk 10,000 steps, because your logical right question is, well, how do I know that's the answer? And that's really what led me to write the book, is to give people essentially the whole roadmap, how the body really works, why this is really what you need to do, and give you kind of like all the information to prove it. And if you really want to dig down deep, everything we say is footnoted. And if you want to dig deeper, you can actually go to the website, the Great Fat Frog website, and every article that's available online, which is most of them, there's a link right there to the article. You can actually read the article.
Oh, I think in today's world, especially most people need to be held by the hand. I mean, you get me into an area that I'm not aware of, that I don't know. I need somebody to hold my hand, bring me through until I get my grounding, and then pretty soon I'm on my own. And I think that Mike, is the way that works with most people. Now, we're running out of time, so do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's thegreatfatfraud.com.
And that's where we can find the book?
There.
Okay, we can buy the book there?
There's a link to Amazon. The book's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and also in the e-book versions, Kindle and Nook, as well as at your local bookstore.
Wonderful. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Take care.
Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Nina Amir is back with us. We're going to talk about writing in November, and there's a very special reason, because in November, the challenge in the blog, write nonfiction in November. That's a challenge to start and finish a work of nonfiction in 30 days. That's accompanied by a 30 days blog post written by experts in the field of nonfiction writing, publishing, and book promotion. Nina, hi, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here, as always.
What are you dressed up as?
You don't want to know what I'm wearing. I'm not dressed up.
Okay.
Not unless it looks like I'm going to bed.
Yeah. By the way, this is what you get when you have an office at home.
It is. You get to go to work in your pajamas.
I love every second of it.
I'm having a pajama party.
I can't tell you how many professional interviews I've done in a robe. What can I tell you? But I did have my tie
on. There's nobody home here but me and the cats, so nobody can see.
Okay. By the way, we're not talking to the cats today.
No, I put her out.
Oh, good. I've got them locked out of here, because the one little cat gets on here, she throws the keyboard off the table, she moves everything around, she knocks off everything that's on the desk, and I'm supposed to talk.
So what about you? Are you dressed up? Are you and Susie dressed up in costumes?
She's wearing her normal black stuff. You know, she came in, she's dressed, whatever. And I'm in a T-shirt and jeans, but we won't tell anybody.
Okay.
Wait, no, she says undershirt. No, that's a T-shirt.
It's an undershirt.
It's an under T-shirt.
There you go.
Okay. It's that, too.
Got it.
That's
no
exciting.
No funny ears. No hats.
That's it, too. Okay, now, let's go back to writing. And now, busy, busy November, what's going on? I know I kind of opened it up.
Okay. Well, so November is busy in general. So, you know, it started out with something called National Novel Writing Month. And there was a guy named Chris Beatty. here in Northern California, I think Berkeley, and he started this with some friends just for the heck of it. He thought it'd be fun to write a novel in 30 days, and they said that had to be 50,000 words. And some people heard about it, and before he knew it, you know, it became a contest, or I guess he must have decided it would be. And he now has something like 200,000 people who participate, and they have a whole system up, and they count words, and if you do 50,000 words in a month and you put them through his little word counter, you win, and you get a little tag that says you won, and all this. So it became a big deal, and they call it NaNoWriMo for short. And so one year I participated in this, and anyway, so I found out about it that way. I heard about it, I participated, and this is what became the big deal in November, and is the big deal in November. So that's how November became the big writing month.
You know what else happens in November?
Now, well, Halloween.
No, bigger than Halloween. No, that's October 31st. That's tonight.
Well,
bigger than Halloween.
The time changes.
No, I turned 27 again.
You turned 27. Well, again. I think there's something even bigger.
What's that?
It's my challenge.
Aha!
My writing challenge.
Let me tell you, every year I grow older, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Okay, how do we get involved in the challenge?
Okay, well, so let me give you some history first. So it's easy to get involved, first of all. You just go to the website, and the website is just writenonfictioninnovember.com. And so what happened was after the year that I did NaNoWriMo, I said, well, what about all us nonfiction writers? Because that's what I do is nonfiction. And I said, there needs to be something for nonfiction writers. And because NaNoWriMo has a NaNoRebel group, and they write nonfiction, but, you know, you want to be legit, and you want to have your own place. So I started writing nonfiction in November, and it's a challenge to start and finish a work of nonfiction in 30 days, and I don't count your writing, you know, your words. There's no word count. You just start anything, an essay, a book, an e-book, a blog, you can't really finish in 30 days, but you can blog a book in 30 days. You know, anything, a book proposal, anything that's a nonfiction work, you do it in 30 days, and you finish it in 30 days. And you can go to the website, and there's a place where you can sign in. There's a page that says participants sign in, and you sign in there, and you say what you're doing. And then there's a status update page, and there's also a Facebook page. If you go to Facebook, you can search for Write Nonfiction in November, and you can go there, and you can chat with people as well and tell them about your project. And so that's really all there is, except that there is a blog, and Write Nonfiction in November is a blog with 30 days of expert blog posts. And here's the funny thing, is the first year I thought, I'll just, you know, start this blog. And I did this huge brain dump of everything that I know about writing, publishing, and promoting nonfiction. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, I'm done. And then the next year rolled around, and I thought, what the heck am I going to do now? I already wrote about everything that I know. And I know a little bit more since last year. But that's when I had the idea to get these guest bloggers on board. And I did, and I got about 25 of them or so, or 20 of them, and I wrote some of the posts, and some people wrote more than one. And every year since, this is the fifth year, I've had guest bloggers, and I have created this backlog, you know, I mean, these archives of posts, and all year long people go there. And that's how my other blog, Write Nonfiction Now, got started. Was I think over about a year and a half ago, I said, well, you know, they're writing nonfiction in November, so it's they're dead. Well, maybe not dead, but sleeping most of the year, all but, you know, 1 month out of the year, and something else should happen the rest of the year. And so I created a sister blog, which is Write Nonfiction Now. So we have Write Nonfiction in November, and then the other 11 months of the year, there's Write Nonfiction Now. And so that's it.
No, that's fun stuff. Now, I get involved. How do I get involved?
You go to the blog, and you go to the participant sign-in page, and you sign in. You don't even have to. You can just read the blog posts, actually, and go write on your own and be anonymous. If you'd like to really participate, you go and you go to the participant sign-in page at www.writenonfictioninnovember.com. Go to the participant page, and you leave a comment there. And you leave a comment saying what you're writing, and I actually even have a contest this year with a book giveaway. I'm giving away a copy of Rochelle Melander's book, Write-A-Thon, which is about how to write a book in 26 days. And if you leave a comment there saying I'm writing an actual book in 30 days, and you tell me how you're going to actually finish it in those 30 days, you can win a copy of the book. But that's how you participate. You go and you sign in, and then you can go to that status update page, and during the course of the 30 days, you can leave status updates saying how your book is going or how your article is going or how whatever you're writing is going. How, you know, give us status updates.
Which is a great idea, because
you can check in there on the status update and tell us whether you finished. But you can also go off and just do it without ever leaving me a comment at all. You can just read the blogs, and you can go home and sit there in your pajamas and write and never say a word. The point is, it's a personal challenge, Michael Ray. It's a personal challenge that you should start and finish something, because the main point is that most people don't write. They say they want to write, and they don't.
Oh, so this is actually pushing a little bit. This is one of those things whereby, okay, you commit yourself, you got people watching you now.
Right. It's like we've talked about before. It's sort of like having an accountability partner.
I mean, that's truly what it is.
Here's somebody who wrote to me, left a comment on the page where you sign in. She said, I've been working on my memoir for 2 years, and I need a challenge like this to be hopeful, to push me into gear and get me going.
Yeah, it's interesting, because so many of us need to be pushed, and that's not just an occasional push. Most people are like that. But if that's what it is, you got the impetus to get it done. And the potential here also is you can come up with some great writers, people who really didn't realize they had that within them.
That's right. And people have ideas, and they just don't they don't act on them, or they feel like they're too busy. You know, they just don't get started, or they get started and they don't finish. And there's more than one person on here who has said that. You know, I had this idea. I'm trying to find the comment from someone who said, I had this idea and I've even dreamt of it. I could see it on the shelf, but she hadn't done it. She hadn't written the word. And so she said, thanks so much for the challenge, because I'm going to sit down now and I'm going to write the book over the next 30 days. We just, sometimes we need that impetus to get us up, you know, off the couch at night and to sit down. You know, somebody said, I'm going to write 2,000 words a day. That's a lot of words. But 2,000 words a day, you know, that's 60,000 words by the end of the month.
You know what I'm going to do?
That's
I just figured it out. I'm going to change the title of my book just a little bit so I can get an audience that I didn't have before. The audience that I'm after, my target audience, are those who watch Days of My Life. Or is it Days of Your Life? Whatever that. What is it? Days of Your Life. Yeah. What is that?
Days of Your Life.
Days of Your Life. Yeah. What are some of the other shows? But what are some of the other shows like that, Nina?
One Life to Live.
There you go. One Life to Live. Okay. All right. General Hospital. Yes. And I'm gonna change the name of the book to The Secret Life of a Talk Show Host. No good.
The Secret Life of Luke and Laura.
Yeah. Well, so much for that. Back to the T-shirt. Okay. I think that there are a few people out there. More than think, there are a few people out there that are talented enough that they don't know that they are. They actually could put something together, and then they put something else together. And who knows what happens, because somebody could buy it, and it can end up to be a series, a movie, or something else, too. So it's a start just to get it going.
Well, it is. The thing is that so many people have ideas, and they have something to write about, and they just need to sit down and do it. And so, and it doesn't have to even be a book, Michael Bray. It could be an article. Or it could be a blog. There's several people who have picked up on my idea of how to blog a book, and they've said that they're going to blog. They're going to blog their books. And that may not end in 30 days, but they'll have the crux of a book or the first part of a manuscript. But they can be doing e-books, or they could be just coming up with, like I said, ideas for articles. People can change the world with a blog or with an essay or an article. They can really create change, and they can affect the lives of other people. And this is how you start, is by just sitting down and doing it. And that's the challenge. I mean, how often do we say, you know, challenge somebody? It's one thing to have a contest like National Novel Writing Month where you say, you know, you're going to win. I mean, granted, they don't really win anything. You know, you just count up the words and you get a little label you can put on your website or something. But this is just a personal challenge to rise up and be your best self, to achieve your goals and your dreams. And that's the reason to get involved, is that you're going to be your best self. You're going to do what you said you wanted to do, and in the process of that, you're going to end up with something. So at the end of November, you have a manuscript that you can then edit, unless you've already done that. Some of the people on the list are saying, I'm going to write for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'm going to edit, you know, so that I have a polished manuscript. But
it gives
the idea
you one...
is that By December, you have something you can submit to an editor or an agent, or that you can self-publish, so that you actually have completed something.
It gives you something else that most people fight for today, and they don't know where to look for it, and they get lost on the way to possibly never getting a hold of it. It also gives you some identity. There are people who need to identify with something, and why not be able to identify with that creativity within yourself and put it out there?
Well, that's right. And a lot of people would like to be creative, and they would have like to have that identity as an author.
Sure. No, absolutely. There are so many people missing that today, that acceptance, that identity, and this is that one thing that could bring somebody everything that what else is there in life for people to be acknowledged for whatever, but it's just to be acknowledged. And what a marvelous gift it would be to be able to be acknowledged to something that came out of your own creative juices.
Right. And you know, the blogging part of it is really interesting. Not that I mean to get off on that, but some of these people really have said, you know, I'm going to start blogging my book. But even just if they blog, there are so many people who have started blogs that have ended up as books, and they never realized how many lives they would touch by getting out there and writing on the internet, you know, that they would have a subject or have something to say that would affect so many people. There's this woman, Jill Smokler. She has a blog called Scary Mommy.
And good.
She has touched thousands and millions of people. Matter of fact, there are companies that are scared of her. When she writes about their products or their companies, they worry what she'll say because it affects their sales. And she now has a book coming out. And, you know, she just got on there and started writing about her life with her kids.
I bet I bet at night when she looks in the mirror, she just smiles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's Scary Mommy. I might have it wrong. I think I might have it wrong.
It's a scary something, whatever it is. Nina, we're starting to run out of time. A website we can find you at.
Well, for that, for the challenge, they can go to, as I said, www.writenonfictioninnovember.com. And for everything else that I do, it's easy to find me at ninaamir.com and then click on through to whatever interests you. It's all there.
Wonderful. Hey, Nina, see you next week.
All right. Happy Halloween.
You too. Good night.
Night.
Give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small.
say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toll. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my plans are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Rob Basso with us. He's the author of The Everyday Entrepreneur. Apply the triple threat of ambition, confidence, and conviction for success on your own terms. And as a matter of fact, he's been recognized. He's a business leader and sought after speaker at corporate private events. And as someone with an entrepreneurial eye for opportunity, he possesses the resourcefulness to turn ideas into successful ventures, and he's done it time and time and time again. Rob, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we come down to it, the word entrepreneur today, especially today, is probably one of the most potent words in the, and I won't even say the business world, in the world, because without the entrepreneur, we may not have any kind of an economy left.
Is it not true that you've heard the word entrepreneur more in the last 6 months than you probably ever heard it in history before? I never thought I'd hear our president utter the word entrepreneur so much. No. But unfortunately, it seems to be synonymous with capitalism, and for some reason that's become a dirty word in the country. And it's really an interesting situation when entrepreneurs are going to pave the way and save our country, but capitalism is a bad word. I don't get it.
Now, by the way, the entrepreneurs, I'll tell you where we've gotten so popular and that word's gotten so popular. Let's go all the way back to the mom and pops. The mom and pops had the stores where you walked in and they put their hand on your shoulder. They patted you on the shoulder. They knew your mom, your dad, your dog, your wife, everybody else, right?
Yep.
And the big corporations came in and they basically drove them out of business because mom and pop couldn't compete with the corporations. Corporations were doing fine for a while. And then we went global. And the corporations couldn't keep up with the global competition. And the global competition started running them out of business just like the mom and pop. So they had to outsource. What happened when they outsourced? They let people go. People didn't have a job. So what did they do? Rob, they became entrepreneurs. They sat down with their computer, and the entrepreneur is skyrocketing right now.
No, I love your explanation of it because it couldn't be more true. I mean, last year there was over 500,000 small businesses that were created. While it's not the highest in history, I do believe in the next 5 to 6 years, regardless of what our politicians say and what are some of the statistics, I think there's going to be a significant increase because it's the least expensive time, I think, in our history to strike out on your own with the power of the web.
No, absolutely. You can sit down with the computer and you can be on the same playing field as major businesses out there. You don't have to have a stock in your backyard, quote unquote, or in your closet. You can order. You can do all kinds of things today. And that old adage about, not adage, but that 6 degrees of separation, what'd you know, 30, 40, 50 people if you reached out. Today, Rob, hundreds of millions of people if you reach out in the right way.
Absolutely. I agree, 100%.
Now, as far as being an entrepreneur, for you, where did that start? Where did you get the bug?
Well, I think I was transfixed with the power of earning money for myself when I was about 11 years old. I'm a product of divorced parents, like, unfortunately, nearly 50% of America nowadays, and I was the youngest of three boys. And bottom line is, my mom did the best she could, but if I wanted to have something in my pocket or that new bike or that new toy, I had to go out and get it. So yeah. My first experience, you know, working was out being a paper boy. I know they don't allow paper boys anymore. They have adults delivering them for whatever reasons, but I think I learned more on that paper route about logistics, about collections, about literally falling on my face and getting up And then you're talking before the sun came up when I was 11, 12 years old, when all my friends were asleep. So I got a taste of it very early on, and I never let go.
You know, one of the wonderful things that we have is if we have a curiosity, we talk to people, we ask questions, and instead of having to go out there and fall down, you can shore yourself up with somebody else's experience. And we're all in a learning process. Rule that I've lived by for many years now is a good teacher knows when to be a student, a good leader knows when to follow. I change hats constantly.
Well, my first significant business venture was started in 1996. It was a company called Advantage Payroll Services, and your statement really couldn't be more true because I would not have been able to have been as successful as the company is today without the help of somebody else. I mean, I didn't have the money. I was a 23-year-old kid. Who in their right mind would take a risk on me? Well, I guess I was kind of convincing because the first person I went to who I had some previous, you know, contact with, presented him with a simple business plan that my father and I came up with, and not even 48 hours later, he agreed, and we're still partners 15 years later. It was basically his cash and my hustle was what made it happen.
You can't ask for better than that. But the learning process also, doing the book, The Everyday Entrepreneur, you had to garner a tremendous amount of what kind of knowledge? Well, no, throw knowledge out the window. Wisdom to be able to put together what you did. And my goodness, it probably gave you a base that you didn't have before.
You know what it did? This entire experience, this is my first book, and I had the opportunity to interview 10, you know, incredibly successful entrepreneurs, successful in their own right. You know, one of the guys was one of the co-founders of Priceline.com. Everybody knows that's a household name, but I also talked to basically your everyday entrepreneur, your millionaire next door, who you've never heard of, but, you know, I learned a lot from them. So this experience, not only imparting some of the things that I knew, but taking the bits and pieces from these people who have completely different life experiences from me, trying to find the similarities and differences, and then presenting them in a way where people can actually get something from it. I'm humbled by the experience about having the opportunity to bring that to people. And I'm excited for, you know, getting feedback on the book. It's been a heck of a process.
Now, by the way, the word similarity, well, with the people that you interview, the people that you've dealt with over the years, have you found one overarching theme that every one of them possessed to make them go forward and be the success that they are and have been?
Well, I think you actually used the word. They never stopped moving forward.
Yeah.
They literally plunge forward in their personal missions, and they push past the no. And that's, to me, the biggest part of it, where no matter what happened along the way, they just kept moving. They never let anything stop them. And, yeah, you could say some of them had a paper route or this or that, but that was the biggest thing. They were in constant motion.
I think one of the things that for a really successful entrepreneur, there's one thing that they have to have. And I don't even know if it's learned, because if you don't learn it, then you have to have somebody holding your hand. We all have a blind spot. There's something about the foundation of how we make our decisions and run a business that is a particular way. I think the successful entrepreneur sees the opportunity behind it. They look at something, and not only do they see what that is, but they also see what it could be, and they're smart enough to get somebody else to look over their shoulder and look through eyes that they don't have to see what those blind spots are and to fill in the gaps.
Well, a good example of something like that is one of the gentlemen I interviewed. His name is Ken Davenport. He's a Broadway producer. And you may not have heard of him unless you're a Broadway fan or get to New York City that often to go catch a show, but he's been behind a handful of very successful shows. He recently revived Godspell. Now, that was out in the late 70s, early 80s,
sure.
And he managed to get himself hooked up with the people who are the creators of Wicked, which is one of the most popular and successful shows in Broadway history. Now, that's not the incredible part. The incredible part is he used the crowdsourcing method and used the web to allow people to invest $1,000 at a time in a Broadway show. Never been done before. Never been done before, never thought of, and he got a lot of heat. He got a lot of heat from people in the industry saying, hey, you know, this is our world. You know, this is reserved for the lifestyles of the rich and famous folk. You can't have regular folk being investing in Broadway shows. and it's actually opening in 2 weeks to huge fanfare and great, you know, possibilities. And I just love stories like that, because he stood an industry on its ear and said, you're not going to tell me I can't do this. I can do this. And he saw his blind spots clearly, and he was able to get around, you know, his own deficiencies and the deficiencies of what people expected of the situation. It's quite masterful and beautiful in its own way.
It's going all the way back to the basic social networking. I think it was Jeff Howell of Wired Magazine, and Mark Robinson, I think it was. They call this phenomenon crowdsourcing. That's where that word first came from. And it was about the collaborative, collective effort of a we as opposed to the individuals.
And I think we're going to see more and more of that become acceptable. And you could look at, you know, models like a lot of these couponing models now, these Groupon, and using the power of many, you know, to benefit. And it really is an incredible phenomenon with the power of the web. But you don't have to have technology to be successful in business today. It's not a necessity. Well, it's a big part of where I think the world is going. There are traditional businesses. There's another woman that I interviewed. Her name is Selena Cuffey. She left her, you know, probably nearly seven-figure job working for big corporate America, Harvard graduate, you know, very bright woman, to import wines from South Africa, because that was where her heritage was from. In fact, she named her company Heritage Link Brands. She didn't just jump off a ledge. She jumped off a cliff trying to do this by herself, but she was wearing her Harvard-trained background as her parachute. So she was prepared yet bold, is what I like to say. And I think that's what the essence of an entrepreneur is, being prepared yet bold, not just leaping forward, you know, and not knowing what they're doing, having that plan and being able to follow through. That's what an entrepreneur is.
And you've got to be just that little bit of different, whatever your value proposition is, why they should come to you instead of the competition. And in today's world, if you know what you're doing, you're fine. If you don't know what you're doing, I think you get swallowed up very quickly. There is a, if you wanted to buy a car, I'm in the Milwaukee area, and there is a place called beepbeep.com. And you could go You can go to the web. You can go to every car dealership in Wisconsin. You can look at every car there is, new and used, to buy. You can negotiate. You can buy a car right then and there. You never have to leave your computer, and you don't have salespeople, and you cut out all the middle people, the middlemen, and you go right to it. And there's that. They were probably the first ones to do it here. There's somebody else obviously going to do it. But you got to be, the first one on the street with the idea, and then you move from there, and then you change it as you go, because everybody else will end up doing the same thing after a while.
Yeah, well, that is truly an entrepreneurial venture. It's taking bits and pieces of things that already existed and making it entirely new. But you don't necessarily have to create something really new to be considered an entrepreneur. Some successful entrepreneurs have seen what the competition has done really well and just made a better mousetrap, found a better way to do something that already existed. And they might not have changed the world or the industry, but it doesn't make them less of an entrepreneur. They went out, they created jobs, they created wealth for themselves, and they're good American taxpayers. And you need those too. Not everybody's a visionary that's an entrepreneur, but that's okay. You said you have to be. You know, there's no rules when it comes to this.
Oh, no question about it. And this is why I love the kind of a book that you have, and guys like yourself. You're saying to people who haven't been out there, who have the idea, they don't quite have the impetus to take that step. And what you're saying to them, it's okay. And you're saying it's okay to be you. It's okay to have an idea, and it's okay to go out there and do the best you possibly can. No matter what the media says, you can still do it.
We hope that the book gives those people that little nudge, maybe not to jump off a cliff, but to at least step off the curb to their own entrepreneurial venture. And for those people that are already running successful businesses, myself included, you need constant reminders of things that you may have learned, and maybe even pick up a few new things in the book. I can't tell you many times I've read different people's work and said, oh, gosh, I wish I should. I've got to get back to doing that. I've really been neglectful about doing that. And then it reinforces it, and you go back and you start doing it again. You know, I think I created a pretty original work with the people that I interviewed. I don't think most of the people that I interviewed are your everyday success stories that people heard about, but their stories will be recognizable. They won't be so distant where you're going to say, oh, this is not me, or this couldn't be me. Every one of the people in my book could be you. And that's the cool part about it. That's why we came up with the name, The Everyday Entrepreneur, because you know, there's a lot of pressure in our society to build wealth. Oh, you know, it's the American dream. You know what? Everybody's got their own American dream. Don't let someone tell you what the dream is, whether that be our government, whether that be your friend around the corner, or the one that's jealous, that you've got a better car. That's all nonsense. You make your own decision on what the American dream is. And I haven't found a country to live in that gave us an opportunity like this one. So forget what the government is doing and get out there and do it on your own. That's the mantra
Absolutely.
Of this book.
No, Rob, no question about it, because we are still America. We still have the freedom of opportunity, and that's not been cut off. And we might as well take full advantage of it, because we're living in a completely different time now, and who knows where the changes are going to be down the road. And today, if you want to be successful, you do it by yourself, and you have the availability and the capability to do so, because if you look in the right places, the support systems are there.
Yeah, you're incredibly astute, and you're right on target. Wow, we could talk about this forever. Sounds like we're cut from the same stone, Michael Wright.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's really what it is, because if we really take a look at the guts of what business is, it was the very thing, that the very core of what this country was about in the beginning. We're supposed to be a place where if you have the idea, you can be anything that you want to be, quote unquote, and that is still available. The one thing we still have, you know, they talk about freedom of this and freedom of that. The one thing that we still have here is still freedom of opportunity, because, Rob, there is a tremendous amount of opportunity still left here.
Well, one of the things that I'm always fearful of, and this came up last year, I'm also the founder of a community bank. Myself and 29 other partners raised $30 million to open a community bank. And believe it or not, in the middle of the recession, we're doing pretty darn well for a small upstart company that's only been around for a few years. We get customers, even though I don't work for the bank, I hear the stories, and I've got thousands of clients of my own that I service at my payroll company. I had a client come in and say, well, you know, we'd like a loan, here's the situation, and they wouldn't sign the personal guarantee for the loan. And, you know, it was a little disheartening. It's like, well, you know, we're prepared, the bank is prepared to give you the money, everything's good to go, but you won't personally sign the loan. Why in the world would a financial institution guarantee the loan if you, the business owner yourself, wouldn't step up and guarantee it? I'm always fearful that, you know, people are under the misunderstanding that that is somebody's responsibility or a company's responsibility to take that. And if the individual doesn't take it themselves, it's just one of those pet peeves. Now, we were able to work around for this individual, and eventually we did get them the loan, because they realized no one would give them the money if they didn't sign personally for it. But it's just one of those things that America needs to be cognizant of, that if you're not willing to put yourself on the line, why would anybody else do it for you?
No, absolutely. No, I completely agree, and there is no question about that. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Rob, do you have a website that we can find you at? And I could talk to you all night. This is great stuff.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. Absolutely. Well, you can check out, there's two different sites. One is BassoOnBusiness.com, and it's BassoOnBusiness.com. And the other one is my book site. It's simple. It's the EverydayEntrepreneurBook.com. I know it's ridiculously long, and the book is for sale on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere you buy books, a Nook, downloadable, and we're looking for people's feedback. I can't help other people unless I know how good the publication was, and the next time I write my next book, make sure that I include all the things that people want in it. That's what I'm excited to hear, people's feedback.
Love every second of it. Hey, Rob, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Have a great night.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're going to feel lonely. Got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm
talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Louis Rodriguez with us. He is the author of It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. He's the son of Mexican immigrants and began writing in his early teens, won national recognition as a poet, a journalist, fiction writer, children's book writer, critic, and he co-founded Tia Chucha Press and Tia Chucha Central Cultural and Bookstore, a cultural center in northeast San Fernando Valley. He's currently working as a peacemaker among gangs on a national and an international level. And let us say, Louis, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. What a heck of a job you're doing. San Fernando Valley. I left the San Fernando Valley. I was in the Sherman Oaks and Encino area probably almost 30 years ago now. And at the time, it didn't necessarily have a gang problem. And I understand that there is a problem there. Let me ask you this. Being brought or living in the area, what causes a gang to live? What causes a person to want to become part of the gang?
Well, you know, everybody's got a different reason, but I do think that there's some community issues and family issues. I see that if there's a lot of empties in people's lives, either in their family, there's not enough stuff going on in the community, gangs tend to fill vacuums.
Yeah.
And I always look at, okay, what's missing in the person's life, this young person, that he would feel attracted to a gang? So then you start going from there. I mean, what's missing is generally either a detachment from their family, or there's not enough love, not enough understanding. Sometimes in the schools, there's too many kids. Even in the valley now, there's, you know, 40, 50 kids to a classroom. There's a lot of ways for people to fall through the cracks. And generally, like I say, the gangs are the ones that are going to pick them up.
Listen, what I felt for a long time, and you're spot on with that definition, because I felt if you're not getting acceptance at home and you don't have an identity at home, you're going to go out where they accept you. And if the gang is going to accept you and give you an identity, and, you know, in many cases, it's worth dying for.
Yeah, you know, that's a very strong point. I know it's hard for some people to imagine that young people could feel that way, but I think for some young people, it becomes important to find a connection, some identity, to know that they belong somewhere. And like you say, some of them are willing to die for it. It's kind of an interesting, strange thing. But it does happen, and I think this is where I think families and communities can come in to fill those gaps, come in there with enough caring, guidance, direction, resources. When kids are in trouble, not just to knock them down or to put them away, but to really address their issues. What is the trouble? Where is it coming from? And to really fill their lives with a lot of acceptance, as you point out.
Yeah, and I think the gangs, that really, I would say, in the last 20, 25 years, you know where Bell, Maywood, Southgate, Huntington
sure,
Park, that
yeah.
is? Okay, I was brought up in Bell. But I was brought up in Bell. I went to junior high school in the 50s there. No gangs, none of it. Okay, and then as we grew in Los Angeles, the gangs started to happen. And I don't quite know when it started and why it got so powerful, and when the family started to separate and lose the definition of what family should be.
Yeah, no, I think Families are very vital to whether gangs are going to exist or not. And there is a lot of broken, relatively broken, some more than others, families in our communities. I also think that gangs really got big. You know, gangs have been around forever, as they say.
Oh, sure.
But gangs really got big in this country in the 80s.
Yeah.
It really exploded. And one good reason, there's several reasons, but one of them was the deindustrialization that was going on in every major city of the country. L.A., people don't know what is and was the largest manufacturing center in the country. People never think of L.A. that like that. They think of Disneyland and Hollywood and beaches. But actually had a lot of industry, a lot of people in East L.A., South Central, Bell, Maywood, that whole area you talked about.
Yeah.
Huge industrial complexes there. By the 80s, they were leaving the big plants, the steel mills, the auto plants, the rubber plants, the aerospace, the shipyards, everything was shifting. And what happened is there wasn't hardly any new kind of industry to replace it. Gangs really exploded around the country at the same time during that. I mean, again, there's other factors, but that's
sure.
One of the big factors that people have to remember.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, you know, it calls you back. What is it, the title? What does the title mean? What's the underlying meaning of the title?
Well, the key thing is that I left the gang life and heroin addiction by my age 20, my late teens. And I thought that was the end. I'm never going to be in that world. I'm never going to go back to jail. I'm never going to be on heroin. But, you know, all my life I've been called back to those streets and that madness. And it took the form of rages that I didn't know I had. I was raging all the time when I least expected it. It took the form of more addictions. I kept drinking for 20 years on top of that.
Yeah.
Abandonment. I left my two oldest kids and really neglected them. In other words, everything that I didn't think I was ever going to be again because I left that world kept calling me back. So the struggle, even for me, who's become a well-known writer, an upstanding member of the community, you know, is I had to keep addressing the healing on my own physical, mental, and spiritual development. I had to keep dealing with it. It doesn't really stop just because you say, I want it to stop. You have to be constantly aware that you'll be called to that madness, that craziness, unless you make a really concerted effort to stay on track for that healthy, decent, conscious way of living.
Yeah, but if you take a look at it, you know, you have to sometimes look back. Tough to go through, no question. But you're going to have to look back and just look up in the sky and say thank you for every bit of it, because if it wasn't for that, you would not be writing the books you're writing. You would not be doing what you're doing now and helping the people that you're helping. So in and of its own ways, Luis, it was a gift.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I'm glad you brought that up. When you read the book, you'll see that I feel totally blessed in the long run. And still, it's a process of change that takes a while. But I am one of the very, very extremely fortunate ones, and I know it. And everything bad that I've seen, things that I witnessed, things that I took part in, never got so bad that I lost it all completely. I almost lost my kids, my oldest kids, but now we're together.
Yeah.
My son ended up doing a total of 15 years in prison, but he's safe. He's okay. He was released last year. In the gangs, I got shot at several times, including point blank range, machine gun fire, and never got hit. I OD'd on heroin and other drugs three times and came back. In other words, I survived things that most people, unfortunately, a lot of people don't. So I am extremely blessed. But I think the biggest gift, if you point that out, is that I found my particular calling, my purpose in this world. I'm doing that now through my writing, through my work in my community center that we established, me and my wife, there in the San Fernando Valley, through my work helping turn gang kids around. In other words, I think I did find those beautiful gifts that I had inside, didn't know it, but now I've found a way to bring them out.
Now, let me ask you about that. I want to go back to gangs for a moment, and then I want to really get into the book. You just said something a moment ago about getting shot at point blank and the, you know, machine guns or whatever. Luckily, you know, you're still here. When I was a kid, you know, when I go back to those days, you know, a couple of kids got in a fight, somebody had a bloody nose, you became best friends, it was over with. Nobody had a gun, nobody carried a knife. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't any kind of violence. We were, Bell's not that far from East L.A., and in those days, I think the only gang we knew of was White Fence. I don't even know if they exist anymore, but that was that in East Los Angeles. And then the weapons started, and the weapons are scary. I mean, you're talking about almost military in and of itself. Why isn't that? What's wrong with the police department? And why don't we have the proper help to get rid of the drugs, to get rid of the weapons on the street, and so people can be safe, because it is dangerous out there.
Well, I think what's a very powerful issue here. One of the things that I saw happening, and I witnessed it, is that there were things going on like the Vietnam War. People were coming back, and people don't make the connection how it escalated some of the gang violence and drug use in the poorest neighborhoods. I'm talking about the black, brown, but also poor white neighborhoods. Vets were coming back, I mean, millions of them, and didn't have no jobs. Some were mentally ill. Some were heroin addicted that never used to be. And I remember them coming back, and they kind of helped escalate the use of violence as well as the use of drugs. There was always heroin in the community, especially after World War II, but they really got worse. But I have to tell you again, in the 80s, when the government declared a war against drugs, it actually made drugs more available. There was more guns and drugs than any time in the history of this country. Guns, all of a sudden, they used to be in small civil wars around the world, ended up in our main urban areas. I'm talking about Uzis and Tech Nines, because I agree with you. When I was a young kid, there was guns. I happened to be involved with the hardcore end of the gang, but most people were fighting. It wasn't guns. They were rumbling, remember? I remember rumbling.
Oh, yeah. Rumbles.
They were doing things like that, and they weren't killing each other. But it started to escalate by the 70s, and then the 80s, it went like a completely different level. Nowadays, you can go to any neighborhood, and kids, small kids, can get access to guns. And unfortunately, almost anybody can get access to drugs, despite all the laws, despite all the police, despite the DEA, despite everything. Even what they're doing in Mexico, it does not stop the trade. My sense of it is we have to imagine a whole new way to do this, because it ain't working, whatever we're doing.
No. Now, do you think that there's money flowing here? You know, there's been an old rule for years with anything. You want to find out the cause of something, the guts of it, you follow the money trail. And the border can't just be the border, they're not looking. You hear what I'm saying? There's got to be somebody, it's got to be a powerful money magnet to those people, or some of those people in power, because if they weren't getting something out of it, we would not have the problem at the border, we wouldn't have the amount of drugs, and we wouldn't have the amount of killings that we're having today.
Yeah, I don't, unfortunately, I've done a lot of research, I've talked to a lot of people, there's a lot of books I have, and that's a kind of similar conclusion that a lot of people seem to make. I don't have any direct knowledge myself, but the conclusions that I get from reading different things and talking to people is somehow some people are making so much money off drugs and guns that they really don't care that it's infiltrating our communities, our families, and it's not just affecting poor people anymore. Now middle-class communities, other communities, it's all over the country, where it used to be just kind of segregated to the poorest communities. Almost anybody has access to these things, and there's such a big industry, billions and billions of dollars. Somebody even said it may be the second largest single industry after oil, if you think of guns and drugs as one combined thing. So somebody's making money off this. And
absolutely.
It's being made at the back of our children in many cases.
Okay, let me ask you this. By the way, the book's a keeper. I have it in my hands. I pick the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I read this book?
Well, one thing is, I think there is different ways to try to heal, and I think that people have to follow what it is that their own particular passions and life is pulling them. I tell the kids I work with, there's five things you have to really try to do. One, find your art, whatever it may be. Find what you love in this world, your passion. If it's teaching, there's art in that. If it's even building cars, there's art in that. Whatever it is, find the art. Two, I tell them to find a community, get help. If you have to create a temporary one, don't do it alone. Don't think you're going to be by yourself. Find a therapist, a teacher, a mentor, somebody who can help you get through this. Three, I tell them, get spiritually engaged, however they need to be. It's very important that they access that part of themselves, because sometimes people don't realize, I think all young people are on a spiritual quest, whether they know it or not. Four, I tell them that they need to, have a cause.
Yeah.
Do something bigger than yourself. Even if being a father or a mother is what it is, that's a great cause. You know what I mean?
Sure.
In other words, have something bigger than yourself. And the fifth thing I tell them that ties it all up is you need to learn eventually to own your life. When you're in a gang, you don't have your life anymore. When you're in drugs, it's not your life anymore. When you're drinking, you turn your life over to other things, other people. And my whole thing is get kids to feel independent, autonomous, and liberated by owning their own life and then taking full responsibility for what they do, and then hopefully realize that what they do matters, that they'll do some good things in this world.
You know, you said the word spirituality, which triggered a thought within me. Effectively, the gang is the be-all, end-all. And the gang is almost like a religion, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it tends to be the same. That's why I think all kids are on a spiritual quest, even these gang kids.
Sure.
Unfortunately, sometimes the institutionalized churches don't speak to them. Sometimes the institutionalized schools don't speak to them. So a gang comes in again. There's gaps. There's empties. The gang fills it, and it fills it just like drugs do. You know, drugs and alcohol kind of spiritually engages you too, only it's a phony engagement. You know, that's why I think they call spirits, they call them spirits, because they're phony spirit, you know what I'm saying? But it tends to get you to that point of the emptiness you feel in your life when you don't have a real spiritual engagement, when you don't feel connected. So I agree with you. I think in many ways, especially the hardcore end of a gang, becomes all-encompassing, just like a cult. Only this cult is a death cult. In other words, what keeps a gang alive is the number of young men that end up dying because or due to the gang.
You know, I remember years ago I was talking to somebody who had grown up in New York, in the worst part of New York, in gang-ridden. You know, his father didn't work. His father drank. His kids hardly ate. There was rats in the house. I mean, this is really terrible. But his mom pushed him. His mom pushed him to the point where he ended up getting a college education and going on to the profession and the field that he wanted to be in. So we were talking one day, and he said, you know, he'd go outside and, you know, somebody look at him across the way, and all of a sudden there's a fight and they're doing whatever. And the question I asked him, I said, when you were fighting with a kid, when you hit him, who were you hitting? And then there was dead silence for a while, and who he was hitting was his father. It was not that kid. He was hitting his father. And I think there's where a lot of the rage comes out, and they don't put the two together.
Yeah, you know, that's so important because one of the work I do is with men. We try to help. Every year I have a retreat for young men, their mentors, therapists, as well as kids, to talk about what is real fatherhood, what it is to be a real man. Not that a broken-down, tough guy that everybody wants to be, but a full, whole, healthy person that our kids are looking for. They're looking for a father that knows how to cry when he needs to cry, but knows how to protect and defend and knows how to stand up when he needs to, knows how to have imagination so that the least way he goes is through violence. You know what I mean? Violence is like the lack of imagination.
I totally agree. Now, we're starting to run out of time now. Website we can find you at.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's part of the work, too. How do we help our young men get the proper guidance, modeling, and mentoring to be young men and to be good fathers? And to be fathers that are worthy of their kids.
Now, do you have a website we can find you at? We're starting to run out of time now.
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to luisjrodriguez.com. That links you to all my books, to my blog, to all my events. I go around the country. I go to other countries. Also, I recommend people go to TIACHUCHA.com. That's Tia Chucha. That's my cultural center and bookstore that I have in the San Fernando Valley. It's a great space. You see all of the work that we do with kids from the babies, well, not quite babies, but really small, to an elderly. In other words, we have full arts programming for the whole community.
Wonderful. Hey, Luis, thank you so much for joining us. Great work. And who knows, one of these days I might walk into your store when I'm in Southern California next time.
You're more than welcome. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Just a jackknife. It has a mega heap, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with its teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. But fancy gloves, though, wears old mega heap, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. I let that thing swing on a sidewalk. Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me,
Could that someone be Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Where cement bags just hanging on down. Oh, that cement is there strictly for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10. Old Mackey's back in town. Yeah, yeah, Bobby Miller. He done disappeared, dear. After drawing out, feels good. All his hard-earned cash. And now Mackey, he spends just like a shade. Could it be our boy's done something red? Come on, come on. Let me dive a hope. Hello, Miss Lottie Linya. Good evening, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right, babe. And now that Mackie's back in old L.A. town. I said, Jenny, dive.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Move it over, Lucy Brown.
Cynthia Gluckman coming up. Cynthia Gluckman with us, author of Daughter of a Porn King, is a popular speaker, a coach who helps her clients find their joy. Cynthia obtained her PhD at age 27 and became a national figure competitor, and was a professor for 7 years, a dean of a college, and a business owner, all before age 35. And let's say, Cynthia, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here. Michael, how are you?
I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. Porn
yeah,
King,
well, I was dancing with your music back there, too. That was
isn't
great.
That great. Yeah, I know. I was dancing over there, too. That's good stuff. Yeah, you gotta get up when you're on the radio, and you got to get a little bit of energy behind you. Cynthia, yeah. Let me ask you this. What an interesting way to grow up. Most kids don't grow up that way. Most kids don't get exposed, especially the way that you were. What did that life do for you? What was the one lesson that as an adult that you brought with you?
Well, I think that everyone can really identify with being thrown into an environment or a situation that they're not really comfortable with. And if you can imagine a 7-year-old girl walking into a porn convention without adult supervision, initially at that time, you know, as a child, I think I was just very confused. And I saw these women that had men lining up for days wanting to get an autograph.
Yeah.
And so to me, I thought, wow, that's what I need to do to be loved.
That makes sense. But,
yeah, right?
Sure. I mean, it truly does make sense. I mean, that was the model. It is this, what's a 7-year-old going to know?
Right. And at the same time, I think that these are some of our defining moments. You know, I work with clients all the time that have childhood things that happen, and we have a choice, right? We can step up and say, you know what, that's not exactly what I want, and we can do something different. And in my book, you know, I intend to help people, to inspire people to see that they also can transform their lives and they can have, do, and be whatever they choose.
Now, by the way, at 7 years old, obviously, you're not going to know what's going on. And most 7-year-olds today won't really know what's going on. But as you grew and as you got an idea of what was going on, how did you look at it through your eyes?
Yeah. Well, I think really there was another defining moment. And as I was growing up, it impacted me pretty severely. And I had eating disorders and struggled with that because I thought, well, it's all about this exterior model, what I need to be. And being a former fatty, I thought, well, people are not going to love me because I'm chubby and I'm fat and I just don't look like these women. At 17, my parents had set me up on a date with a 36-year-old, And the reason they had set me up on this date is because he was a multimillionaire, and in their minds they thought, oh, well, we're taking care of our daughter. We want to be sure that she'll have a great life. And here's this guy who's 36 years old slamming me up against his car, thrusting his tongue down my throat.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I realized, wow, this is not the life for me. My skin began to crawl, and I came to the realization that, you know, if I'm going to succeed, if I'm going to take care of myself, I want to go, I'm going to get an education, I'm going to do everything but what I see these women doing in this industry. So for me, it was a catalyst for who I've become, and, you know, a great opportunity. To me, I see this as like our golden nuggets in life, these things that may seem like they're terrible.
Yeah, most people, Cynthia, the challenges that most people have, when you take a moment and you look at them afterwards, now, tough going through, there's no question about that. But if you look at them afterwards, it's the direction they forced you to take. And look at everything you've done before you were age 35 years old. And it's quite possible that if you had not been through what you've been through prior to that, you would have never accomplished the things that you accomplished in your life. And you would not have been able to touch the people you touch through your work.
Right. Yeah, I feel very blessed in that. And I even have a client who reminds me of that, because he was the economy was taking a nosedive in the last 5 years, I would say. His business was hurting very bad, and didn't think that he was going to be able to make it. And by working with him and really helping him to get in touch with his inner joy, he actually was able to realize, wow, you know, what an opportunity this was, because the truth was the business that he was doing wasn't even his passion. It never had been.
You know, I wonder how many people get stuck into that. I mean, obviously not a number, but there are so many people today. They go into things because, number one, they think everybody else wants them to be in that business. Number two, it's about something, some fantasy that they think they're going to be because they're not. And when they end up in it, they end up very unhappy because they try to be somebody else's perfect person, and it never works out. At my optimum best, Cynthia, I can only be the second best you. No matter what I did, I could never be as good at being Cynthia than you can. And that's where I think the problem is. If you want to find joy, you have to be your own first best you, and you have to be who you are and not who you think someone else would like you to be.
Absolutely, yeah. It's definitely a message that I share with people, and it's one of the 7 steps of my 7-week program that I do with my clients, and just helping them to align with that, to find out what that is. I mean, who can't identify? I'm sure everyone has been in a situation where they felt like they were boxed in and locked up into something, and it was really because it was external pressures, and it had nothing to do with what was internally making them happy.
And let me ask you this. And most people run into the same thing. If you decide to put anything to pen, authors go through this, whether it's fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, whatever the case may be. There's that time somewhere as you're writing the book, the light bulb goes on. There's that aha epiphany moment where you begin to realize there's a dimension of the subject matter that you weren't aware of before you started. Where was that for you? Where was your aha moment?
That's a great question, because I've been very reflective throughout my life, and it's, again, part of, I would say it's really the first step in finding your joy is being reflective and looking at the patterns that we've created, which is something that really, really became apparent in my book, is looking at the patterns that were created, for example, with my father, and how that's impacted the relationships that I've continued to have with men. And it took me many, many years to finally have a healthy relationship with a man. And so that's, I love writing for that aspect. And I actually I work with clients all the time, and that's one of the tools that we use is using writing in order to get to that if they are not able to achieve it through other tools.
You know, two of the interesting things, I'm listening very close to you, I'm hearing two things. One is most people don't get this. I've asked people time and time again, I'd say something to the effect of describe your father emotionally to me or describe your mother emotionally and then describe your husband and wife. You usually get one of the two of them going. And we end up with the same person in a different body all the time. And when you break it within you, then you find people who you really want to be with. And I think that's extremely important to get. Until you cover or you fill up that gap, what was empty or what was missing between mom and dad or whatever, you're going to keep finding the same person, you'd find them. And also, the other thing I'm hearing is your dad had to be very motivated in what he did to accomplish what he did. And it sounds like you picked up the same motivation, but put it in a constructive area.
Oh, yeah. I look at the things that my dad passed down to me, and he taught me some really great skills. And so, again, that comes back to one of the joy tips, really, one of the steps to achieving your joy is to be able to look at what might seem like the bad things in our lives and find out, extract, what are the good things? You know, what did I get out of that? My dad was very disciplined. He would go, you know, he worked very hard in order to achieve the things that he did. And so for me, that was very natural, although I'm, again, like you said, I went in a completely different direction. So that's definitely one of the steps. So it sounds like you've already taken my program.
I was sitting in the back. You didn't recognize me. But when it really comes down to it, it's being able to look through it, finding that quote unquote blind spot. And if I have to use that word 1,000 times a month, and you know, if the message gets out there, we do. We have blind spots, and sometimes it takes a challenge. It takes somebody else through looking over your shoulder through different eyes to uncover that blind spot, and all of a sudden you get to see who you really are. And if you got the guts to go forward with it, then life's pretty good no matter what goes on with an economy.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of the blind spot, I'm exactly with you. I mean, again, and Daughter of a Porn King, that's really the underlying message, is it doesn't matter who your daddy is, it matters who you are. And what that means is it doesn't matter if the economy is terrible, you create your own economy. And the third step in my 7-step program to achieving your joy is really transforming those beliefs that you have. If we believe, oh, it's a terrible economy, so I'm gonna not succeed, well, then you've already created that reality.
Sure.
And by working with a coach or somebody that can help you to see those blind spots, then once you have that awareness, oh, this is my thought process, and if I just shift that. In fact, I remember Rush Limbaugh on an interview. It was so awesome. He said, they asked him, I don't remember what his contract was for. It was like, you know, double-digit millions to do his radio show. And the interviewer asked him, gosh, you know, don't you feel terrible that you just signed on this huge contract with the economy being what it is? And Rush said, well, whose economy? My economy is great.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. Yes, good, you know, applaud for him. Because, that's really the way it is. You know, we still live in a country that you have freedom of opportunity. You can get what you want. And it's still out there. All you have to do is have the impetus to get it and stop, and not you, but stop listening to the media and listening to people who say you can't do it because it's them. Don't live anybody else's life.
Well, and that, you know, that brings me to the next step of that. Like, once you shift your beliefs around all of these things, then you become magnetic. Instead of being on that, you know, people get so caught on that treadmill, like a hamster on the wheel, and they're running and they're thinking, oh gosh, eventually I'm gonna make lots of money, or I'm gonna have the perfect relationship. And if you just step off the wheel and stop trying to chase it, and you just really shift the way you think about it and let go of all that old baggage, you become magnetic, and those things are the dreams start coming to you rather than you having to chase after it. So
let me give you a prime example of that. Okay, you and I are standing in a room, and you're standing there, and you're very stiff. You've got your hands down at your thighs on the outside, and your legs are together. Your ankles are touching. You're very stiff and rigid. And I'm standing in front of you, and I push you with a certain amount of pressure on at your chest. You're going to fall backwards. But let's say now we're in the same situation that, you know, you move your legs apart, you get your balance, and I push you. You're not going to fall. And what I'm saying here is a simple shift in your position, and everything's the same, except the outcome's completely different.
Yeah. I love that visual. I also have an example of a client. This is kind of silly, but, you know, the work that I do with the joy, helping people to get to that more relaxed state, really is what that's about, right? And
sure.
Being in that joy. I had a client that had irritable bowel syndrome, so she was literally having a hard time eliminating. And when we went back into her beliefs and her patterns in her life, she had been abused as a child. I mean, it was pretty severe stuff, actually.
Sure.
But when we went back, I mean, it literally was within a 45-minute coaching call, she was able to release that, shift her programming, her mental idea of it, rewire herself, and I kid you not, the next morning, so she told me, she got off the phone, she's like, oh my gosh, I feel great, I feel so different. The next morning, I get a text message from her saying, wow, I can poop, I can poop.
I would have, you know what I would have done as an entrepreneur? I would have gone out and bought 1,000 t-shirts, and I would have put that right on his chest. I would have sold them. We're starting.
Oh, I love that, right? But it's so amazing how we're so connected to our bodies even. Our bodies are responding to what's going on with us emotionally and mentally. And she literally was not eliminating these past emotions. And by letting those emotions go, she was physically able to eliminate as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We're running out of time, but I want to leave it with this.
Oh, no.
Talk to you all night. You're delightful. But there was a client. There was a guest I had on one night. His name is Riz Mirza, and he's a psychic. And there was on his press release, there was something he had on there that I cut out and I kept because it just makes so much sense. And it's this. He said, people ask me what happens after you die. And I ask them what happens when you finally live.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
website,
and that's
website.
What being in the joy is all about.
Oh, absolutely. Now, website we can find you at.
Yeah, you can go to yourjspot.com. That's Y-O-U-R, J-Spot. And the 7-week program that I was mentioning, you can go sign up there. And also, you can go download right now 101 Joy Tips. They're free. You can get updates on just tips and different techniques and strategies on living in the joy. And also, this is so exciting. My book just came out, Daughter of a Porn King. You can find it on that website under the books, and it's available everywhere. Kindle, Amazon, all the, you know, everywhere. So, Daughter of a Porn King.
Wonderful. Cynthia Glickman, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a great night.
Good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your tears and laughter will linger after.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you again. But now